Hey, it's Andrew, the Director of Literary Arts. Here at Literary Arts, we rely on our community, people like you, for support. To help make this podcast and all our programming possible, give today, literary-arts.org/donate. Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project is provided by Cole Haan. Cole Haan's shoes, bags, and outerwear go with you while you work your way to extraordinary. More at colehaan.com. In this episode, we're broadcasting an event that took place at the Portland Book Festival in 2019. The panel, titled Self-Portrait, Memoir, Autofiction, and History, features three incredible Oregonian writers, Deborah Gwartney, Mitchell S. Jackson, and Peter Rock. It was moderated by Elena Passarello. What is shared between these writers are projects that attempt to reconstruct a past in order to understand the present. They have not simply written personal accounts of their lives, but they have widened the lens and scope of their books to account for the communities that shaped them, the historical forces that shaped their communities, and the lives they have led, both their interior lives and as actors in the world. To me, this work is exhilarating because it connects us all to the course of time, helping us see we are not merely alone in shaping our lives, but part of the mysterious currents of the past, personal and historical, that play a role in defining who we are. Here's our moderator, Elena Passarello.
Well, hello, everybody.
I'm Elena Passarello. I'm going to introduce our fine panelists. And when I introduce each person, they're going to read just a little bit of an excerpt from the book that we're going to be discussing today. We're going to be talking a lot about writing about the self and writing about what we are calling a collective history, things that live outside the self. And I think our panelists are each going to read an excerpt that sort of speaks to that. So why don't we just go right down the aisle, starting with the gentleman to my right. This is Mitchell S. Jackson. Mitchell S. Jackson's debut novel won the Ernest J. Gaines RIP Award for Literary Excellence. His honors include a Whiting Award and fellowships from the Cullman Center of the New York Public Library, TED, the Lannan Foundation, the Ford Foundation, Penn, the New York Foundation for the Arts, and the Center for Fiction. His writing has appeared in The New Yorker, Harper's Magazine, The New York Times Book Review, The Paris Review, The Guardian, and elsewhere. He's the author of Survival Math and an assistant professor of creative writing at the University of Chicago. Take it away, Mr. Jackson.
Hi, can y'all hear me? I think I'm the right distance from the microphone. Yes, all right. I'm reading an excerpt from an essay titled Exodus. My exodus occurs after years wandering the wilderness of my hometown, the crucible that included working a part-time and only time gig at the Oregonian's downtown insert facility, stacking pallet after pallet of inky-ass newspapers. For bread to live, for bread to leave. The day in question, I got a phone call from someone who, for the love and just maybe his liberty, I'll call Brother A. Brother A called me to plead a ride to his apartment in the burbs to sweep for dope after his dope-dealing roommate, a dude who'd already done a nickel in the pen on a drug charge, which, by the way, is not judgment, just context, had just gotten knocked by the feds. Brother A explained he needed the ride because his main squeeze had wrecked his Jeep and he couldn't think of anyone more fitting than me, of all people on God's green earth, me, to shuttle him. Hell no. That should have been my answer, but that was not my answer. My answer tugged me out of my job at the end of my shift and on into the forest evergreen Lexus I'd bought in the bygone unblessed days when I sold more than weed. It sent me bolting out of my job and into my ride to swoop Brother A from someplace close and hit Highway 26 with most dubious sense. Guessing now is as good a time as ever to mention that this was the age during which I might have been selling 20 sacks, ace, halves, and whole zips of weed. In the most blessed of times, half and whole pounds, selling chronic stacking newspapers and throwing parties because evermore this brother, every brother, should diversify his hustle. No mites or maybes to that. Memories from that age, hypothetical and otherwise, seldom feature date stamps, but I can assure you this incident occurred May 2002, which I know for truth because one of my homeboys and me had just thrown a well-attended Memorial Day shindig, and in between my cut of the door profits and the weed I may have been selling, I had a knot of bills in my inky work jeans, which accounts for why at the time I was feeling at least extra medium about myself. Brother A and I traded weight, lightweight banter en route, and before I knew it, we reached his apartment. Complex grounds of such expanse, there was plenty of time for my post to cease between the moment I pulled in the lot and when I found a place to park my tree-colored ride. Can't speak for Brother A, but in the interstice of arriving and stepping a wary foot out of my ride, I have visions of police swarming us from bushes and vans, seizing discomfited me, slamming my cheek against unforgiving asphalt, and kablowing on cuffs. We did not, word to God, get ambushed that moment. We hustled past a passel of blithe youngsters and mounted a flight and a flight and a flight of stairs and stood at the threshold of his apartment door, my heart a-thunder, and asked each other again and for the last time if we should enter, which, inhale, of course we did. Breathe, breathe, breathe.
Thank you, Mitchell. And to Mitchell's right is Ms. Deborah Gwartney. Deborah Gwartney is the winner of the 2018 River Teeth Nonfiction Prize, judged by Gretel Ehrlich, for her memoir, I Am a Stranger Here Myself. Her 2009 memoir, Live Through This, was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award, the Pacific Northwest Booksellers Award, and the Oregon Book Award. Deborah has published in such journals as Granta, Tin House, The American Scholar, The Normal School, Creative Nonfiction, Prairie Schooner, Tri-Quarterly Review, the New York Times Modern Love column, among others. She's the 2018 winner of the Real Simple Essay Contest and a contributing editor at Poets and Writers Magazine. She's received fellowships from Hedgebrook, Playa, UCross, and the Wulitzer Foundation. And she teaches in the MFA program at Pacific University and lives in Western Oregon with her husband, the writer Barry Lopez. Deborah.
Wow, it's an honor to be here, truly. And I'm just going to read the first page and a half of this book. A man is following me on US 93 in Idaho, his red truck a firecracker in my rearview mirror. It's a rumbling diesel truck with a toothy grill and road-gobbling tires, and when the sun's rays tilt just right as we wind through the narrow canyon, the ram on his side panel glints like a neon sign. After about an hour of this guy on my bumper, I start to wonder if it's what he's planning to do to me, one good ram. I'm a little pissed at the bubble of fear rising in my throat. I should be able to hold my own even on an isolated road in Idaho with brilliant sun splashing across an empty June day, but I don't like how near he is or how alone I am. I'm betting he spotted my Oregon plates and my I'm with her bumper sticker and wants me and my kind off his road. It's not like he's honking or flashing his lights, but his truck is twice the size of my hatchback and the rifle rack behind his head holds a weapon clicked in tight. Plus, the man keeps closing in on me. We're on a windy two-lane stretch between the towns of Salmon and Chalice with no cars in either direction when he looms again in my mirror and revs his engine. I think about sticking out my arm to flip him off, but instead I do what this Idaho man wants and I pull over. I need to pee anyway, so what the hell? I tap on the brake and veer into a rest area at the top of a piney rise. He roars off and I step out on cracked asphalt, awash in frustration and disappointment. But disappointment about what exactly? That he found me out? That he stared into the tan vinyl interior of this car with its fuel-efficient engine and pegged me as a late middle-aged white and left-leaning woman? Nail on the head, buddy, and it was a right thing that we parted ways, though I sort of wish I'd waved him over to park next to me so we could talk. Could we talk? Mostly, I want to let him know that I am a fifth-generation Idahoan, and I have the right to drive along the river's edge and weave through this undulating landscape without someone pushing me to hurry along. I tell him that when I was a kid with my father at the wheel easing through these curves, I felt in my body every bend and straightaway from our house in Boise to Salmon, while smells of river and sagebrush and baked earth poured in the window. I knew the drive by heart, but I stuck my face out anyway to imagine how all this around me was once formed by a herd of lumbering dinosaurs that one day plopped down and turned into the tawny mottled hills of eastern Idaho. But of course, when I was a kid, half dozing in the back seat of the station wagon, heading to my one and only best place on earth, I let myself believe a lot of things that I can't anymore.
Thank you, Deborah. And finally, to Deborah's right, we have Peter Rock, the author of the novels The Night Swimmers, Spells, Click-A-Tat, The Shelter Cycle, My Abandonment, The Bewildered, The Ambidextrous, Carnival Wolves, and This Is the Place, as well as a story collection, The Unsettling. The recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship, a National Endowment of the Arts Fellowship, an Alex Award, and others, he's a professor in the English department of Reed College. Pete.
Thank you. It's sweet to be here, especially with these authors I admire, and I will try to be worthy. I'm also going to read from the very beginning of my book. It has a bit of a prologue, so this is the whole of that. To swim with another person out in the open water at night across a distance without stopping is like taking a walk without the pressure, the weight of having to carry a conversation, to bring what is inside to the outside. Think of being with someone in a silent room, the tension in the air. Water is thicker, and you can't talk, can't stop moving. Instead, you're together, struggling along, only glimpsing each other's silhouetted arm or head for a moment when you turn your face to breathe, a reassurance that you are not completely alone. I remember the straight black line of Mrs. Abel's clavicle, her shadow on the road that summer overlapping mine, her collar hanging open another time, her thin hand on the toaster, pushing down the lever, then her palm hovering there, feeling the heat. The low whisper of her voice, her stories of shipwrecks and death's door, the floor of the lake like the forest floor, bones and timbers collapsing, scattered by the currents. I remember Mrs. Abel's slender arms, one then the other, bent above the surface of the water, her face flashing in the moonlight. We swam through the darkness, parallel, rising and falling across the black swells. Ahead, the distant silhouette of the tower. Headlights winked through the trees, cars driving the road atop the bluff. I breathed to my right, she to her left, checking for each other. Below us, depths.
Awesome. Thanks, everyone. The descriptive sentence for this panel says that we are here to celebrate three books that combine and move between personal and collective histories to probe both the past and the present. So I thought maybe I'd start by asking our three authors about this literary arts determined phrase, collective histories, and how you would define that in terms of the way that you might be using it in your books, and what it means for the project that you're working on. And I think it might be fun to ask our fiction interloper last. So maybe Mitchell and Deborah and then Pete.
I guess I wasn't thinking about it in terms of collective history, but I was actually thinking about community. Uh-huh. And thinking about, I think in when I was writing my novel, I understood I had like a vantage of my community that was maybe 20 years or maybe like back to Vanport. But I really wasn't thinking about how the history of Oregon had shaped, you know, how I was living in the 1980s and 70s and 90s in Northeast Portland. And so I think I got to kind of scope wider to understand why the things were happening to me. And it always starts with either a personal story or someone I'm connected with. So I think there's the kind of collective history is like, if I don't feel like I have a stake in it, then I think there's plenty of things that other people have a stake in that they would do better at exploring, and so I always want to have a stake and what I do. And for me, that's, I mean, it really comes out of Northeast Portland. It's a very specific place, but in Northeast Portland is a, you know, a microcosm of everywhere.
So the Northeast Portland connection was kind of your starting collective history, but then the project sort of asked you to widen that scope?
Yes.
And I know toward the very beginning of the book, we go way wide,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about how the widest that we go in terms of Pacific Northwest history?
I don't know if it's the widest, but to the very first black person on record to step foot in Oregon, which I think it's 1877. I'll have to go back and look. Marcus Lopez. And so he was killed, which I thought was very indicative of kind of the black presence in Oregon thereafter. Even though he was killed by natives, I just thought, wow, like this is very symbolic about how black people have been here and there. You know, if we go into the exclusion law, then, I mean, here we are. I mean, I think if you kind of looked at this room, this is probably about right percentage-wise of the makeup of Oregon.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you. And we'll definitely come back to that. Deborah, how about you? How were you defining collective history and imparting it in your project?
Well, just like Mitchell said, I sure wasn't thinking about the term collective history. But I knew that I wanted to come at this book as a memoirist, not as a scholar or a historian. I wanted to tell a story about the conflict in myself, which I think is the most important thing a memoirist can do. And the conflict in myself was that I benefited hugely from being raised by Idaho family, but an Idaho family and that who I adore and respect. But I also had this other part of me that knew I didn't fit there. I didn't like the patriarchal nature of that family or the conservative values and politics. And so those two things have been thrashing around in me for a long time. And I thought, well, how can I get to that and talk about this idea of the West? And so my stretching out was to the very first Caucasian woman to cross the Rocky Mountains, this woman named Narcissa Whitman, who was killed violently by natives and deserved it. So she became this thing that I kept trying to go back to, and I realized pretty early on that the only way it was going to work for me is if she was a pry bar into looking into my own history. And so every time I would kind of veer away from that, I would have to come back and think, so how did she kind of open up something that I don't really want to look at in my own self or my own history? Mm-hmm. And as long as I could keep that going, then I felt like I was writing an interesting narrative.
Did you have an idea, for the idea of, did Narcissa show up in the inception of this project, or did Narcissa come later in the, I'm on a first name basis with her apparently. Did Whitman, yeah. Narcissa yeah. Whitman, yeah. happen later, or was it right at the beginning of this memoir activity that you wanted to engage in?
I can't remember. I just know that I read a book about her and I thought, oh my gosh, this is not the story I heard as a kid. And and from then on, I mean, so much has been written about her. I didn't want to write another book about her. So I wondered, how could I write a book about myself and with her in it somehow? It was an impossibly hard thing to do. It was hard, but anyway, I did.
Oh man, I have a million questions about that. Okay, so pause. Pete, what do you think about, is collective history something that you engage with at all as a fiction writer? Does a novel writer think about this idea of maybe a fact-based representation of people remembering when he begins a project like this? Or is there another word for it, maybe?
I don't know. I mean, I think collective history, or even, like, my publisher came up with autobiographical novel, which is not something that I would have said. And the book is definitely very different if you know me as opposed to if you don't know me. But my goal in writing all these books is to have people read them who are not my friends and family. And so it hasn't happened that way. But I guess my answer would be, I don't think there is any other kind of history. So when I'm writing fiction and I'm writing about a character, I think a person doesn't have an identity except through interactions with other people.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's also how we understand ourselves. Mm-hmm. And I think our understanding of other people, which is internalized, doesn't necessarily bear a perfect correspondence with who that person is, but it's who they are and how they're informing us. So how other people feel about us, how they've treated us. I think it's impossible. I think, of course, in different ways, Deborah and Mitchell have dealt with this, but writing from one's own experience, it's just a really self-indulgent thing to do. And I think if you're good at it, you're aware that it's self-indulgent and you're trying to figure out how to complicate it or why that is an interesting question. And so when I'm in this book writing from my experience, I'm really trying to pay attention to the people who made me the person I am or the people who confused me the most or the people who I didn't appreciate the way I might have. Then and trying to, if not make up for that, at least deal with it or account for it. And I think whether you're a fiction writer or a nonfiction writer, I was kind of flashing on the way over here. I used to live in Philadelphia, and I remember being in a room with John Edgar Wideman, and he said, you know, if you write about things that you care about, that you really care about, then you're not going to f*** up. And that, and it's sort of, that's, I guess, where I started.
So Pete, I want to maybe circle back on something that you just said, that in order to depict the self in writing, no matter how you're doing it, what you're really depicting is interactions with other people. That's how we know who we are, right? I am a part of all that I've met or whatever. I think in all three of these books, you guys are interacting with people that you've never met before in some capacities. Is it Robert or Albert Zahn, Pete, the artist who lived in Door County where your novel is set, whose house got lifted?
I think his name is Albert Zahn. I think it might be different in the novel.
Albert Zahn, a historical artist figure, would make air of little wooden instruments. Deborah with Narcissa Whitman and other people, and Mitchell with a lot of source material, right? Could you give an example of maybe an artifact that allowed you to sort of use that for self-reflection or give you that interaction with other people self thing with someone that you've never met before, all three?
The copper penny.
Okay.
So when I was young, the copper penny was like a very discriminatory nightclub. I didn't even know why it was called the copper penny. but now I think it's still across the street in the Oregon Historical Society, right? The copper penny that the two founders of Oregon, Lovejoy and Overton, flipped about who was going to get to name the city. As soon as I heard copper penny, I was like, oh yeah, I remember them. They wouldn't let me in the club. and then after that, it was like, well, where did this thing come from? And why are these two people here? And how did they get to name it? And, you know, well, what is it, you know, how is that kind of branched off to the city of Portland? And that got me to think, looking a little further along, and, you know, there's white supremacy, and they're having, like, Klan meetings with the mayor and the chief of police. And so, but it all came from them discriminating on me. They grabbed my jeans and said I couldn't get in, and forever, now they get this. Yeah.
And how did interacting with those people that you've never met before sort of shape the way that you're appearing as the sort of, I see you in your book as a real kind of like Columbo, kind of inquisitor, interlocutor,
yeah.
You know, you're pushing through, you're maybe not scratching your head as much as Columbo, but like this sort of driven detective.
Well, I think people call this book a memoir. I always imagine it as essays.
Okay.
So really, what is at the heart of all of these things is an idea. So at the heart of that, it's like, well, how did I get this Portland? Right. That's my question.
Okay.
And then from that, I get Dear Marcus, or you know, what? Why did my mother struggle with addiction for so long? From that, I get, oh, maybe it's a long-term marriage. So to me, it's not necessarily the people, it was the idea. And then it was like, well, what people do I need to examine in order for me to uncover what I need to answer this question that's burning in me right now?
And the question is, why did I get this particular Portland?
Well, that's for one of them. Okay. It might be like, why were all my friends dying? Or not dying, being killed? And then from that, I'm like, okay, well, what does survival mean? And where does this idea of survival come from? And, you know, is a gang a nation?
Is a gang a nation?
Is a gang a nation?
Nice. And
it is.
So essays for you is the organizational principle.
Yeah.
And for you, is the difference between an essay and like a novel or these chapters?
Yeah.
I know I had a friend of mine yesterday say that she's trying to get a book sold, and her agent said, you can call it anything that you want, just don't call it essays.
Yeah, essays don't sell. Yeah.
Which, yeah. I've only written essays, so yeah. I'm just going to get up and leave right now. I'm totally screwed. But what is it about what happens in survival math that feels particularly essayistic to you?
It's the question. It's always, sir. I think a memoir is like a story.
Okay.
You know, it's a story with a person at the heart of it, right? And then I think essays start with a question, mm-hmm. and they may include some people to get to it. But I mean, you could write an essay without really talking about a focus on a person. But yeah, to me, it's like idea,
right,
versus story,
right. That's great. So let's all know that these are essays when we read this book, right, Stephen? One of my students is up here. Essays Forever. Stephen has a great essay collection out right now. Deborah, how about you? Is there an example of an interaction with another person that you've never met? It doesn't have to be Narcissa, that particularly, but it could be that you that fueled your project.
You know, I recently had a review of the book that said the only person who's truly interested in Narcissa's hair is the writer. She thought it got very tedious in the book. Bummer that she said that, because I really am interested in the hair, and that's it got me.
Is this idea that her hair has become this artifact that's in various places all around the Pacific Northwest.
It's all over the country, actually. So she was killed violently, and her hair got scattered. She was very famous for this gorgeous hair. It got scattered all over the mission, and it became this thing for mountain men to go and pick up pieces of her hair to carry around. And so I started going to these these archives to look at her hair, and it didn't take me very long to realize, well, this is not the same hair off the same person. There's just no way. I mean, it was different textures, different colors, different everything. You know, I thought, this is not her hair. Who knows which of these are her hair?
Unless Narcissa had, like, extensions or something. Or, yeah.
That's right. It's like you know, all the bone artifacts or the relics of John the Baptist. You know, I mean, he must have had 20 legs. But it just, it fascinated me to think, why was it so important to these various people to have a story? I mean, her hair comes with these long letters about, I have her hair and I've carried it around for 20 years. It's so important to me. And I thought, wow, people need to identify with her so desperately that they have to make up all these narratives about her hair. And I became more and more interested in that. And, you know, I went to Whitman College, named after them, and they let me touch the hair. They let me take it out on the table. It was a crazy experience. And I realized after a while, well, I'm doing the same thing. I'm concocting this mythology about her, my own mythology, doing all this hair stuff. And so I became one of them. And it really got me going on the whole idea that my book is really about the stories we tell ourselves in order to form an identity. You know, then the hair grew into a bunch of other things. So I finally realized that the way to organize my book was around the artifacts that I was finding about her. There's a bottle of red wine named after her, which I thought was very bizarre. Wow. And a trunk that somebody said was her. And so the more artifacts I found about her, the more I realized this is a story about identity, how she became somebody totally different than who she really was to serve others' needs and interests, mm-hmm. and how I was doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm. I love that both of you are talking about writing the self, right? Writing about, asking questions about your lives, but you're going to the library, you're going to the archives and taking out a bunch of hair. You know, you're engaging in these kind of immersive activities that you don't necessarily hear when a lot of people talk about memoir. They're like, I put on my stretchy pants and I got a cabin for 6 months, and when I came out, I had a memoir. I think it's wonderful to think of telling the stories of our lives by going outside of ourselves and searching inward too. I think that's awesome.
I am a big fan of stretchy pants, though.
Oh yeah, me too. I actually have like a little countdown on my clock for when I get to go back to my stretchy pants. That's going to be the title of my memoir, is Stretchy Pants, a Memoir. Pete, though, I wanted to say, you had an activity for your novel that seemed to involve inside and outside. I don't know if you, I think I'm right in this, based on the acknowledgments page of your novel. Did you do like literal immersion work for this?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, one thing that was happening with this book and was that I was trying to account for it in real time, and it was the first time that I was saying earlier today, I was sort of blessed with having, my daughters were younger then, and they were at that age when they were simultaneously saying things all the time that were really incredibly deep and kind of stupid, and trying to figure out where those why they were resonating with what I was doing. And then also I started feeling like I was rooting around in the past, and people began to contact me. My publishers asked me not to talk like this, but it was
not to talk like what?
Like this. But it was as if they felt that I was involved in that period of time and that I was troubling it, and they were picking at it also. And so it turns into a part of the book where an ex-girlfriend of mine sends me all the letters that I wrote to her over a period of time, and which also resonates with some of the work in Mitchell's book. And in it, she said, you know, I was in an isolation tank the other day, and I had these visual images, these snapshots of when we lived together in New York, and I could see your hand on the steering wheel of your truck, and I could see the place where we washed our clothes. And I thought, I was just trying to take clues as I was writing, and I thought, this is something I should do. I'm writing about swimming. I've got to start spending a lot of time in isolation tanks. And that was also a place where I could be removed from time and space, and where I could see what came to me and see how things might be connected in ways that I didn't think they would be. So the answer is yes.
So what are we talking about here? Are we talking like how many dips in the tank while you're putting the book together? I mean, if this is a writing practice, I'd like to sign on. Can I do it in my stretchy pants? No, I'm just kidding.
No. Probably over 20 times.
Wow.
It's a very strange and fortunate life that I lead, but I have this research money, and I can really only buy so many books, and I can't travel because I'm a housewife. And so I did all my travel inwardly, so I get Reed College to pay for me to go up to Hawthorne and float for 90 minutes at a time. Or longer.
That's the panel that you have to do after this, is how to get your university to pay for you to sit in a sensory deprivation tank.
Yes.
So, and then in the novel, there are moments where the speaker is in one, and then there's this tonal, I don't want to describe this incorrectly, but there's a tonal, it's a novel about swimming, and then there are these moments where we don't know kind of if we're above the water or below the water. There's a major plot point where someone, she goes somewhere where she can breathe, but she swims to it, and it's like kind of this Atlantis moment. Did you like just jump out of the tank and run to a pad of paper and write down this feeling? How did the experience translate to what you ended up writing about?
It was difficult to see how many things I could hold. But it did jump up, and sometimes I'd jump out of the tank and back into the tank as I was trying to keep up. But I think that, you know, you're right that there's the sense of, for the purposes of this panel, I became interested in the book as something that accounted for real things in my life, which is something I'd never done before, because I think we all have an external life and an internal life. And swimming is very much a process of keeping track of what is above the water and what is below the water and checking back and forth in the same way as being awake and being asleep. And I've always been sort of furious about that priority of things being just your imagination or just a dream. And not making those distinctions in a book was interesting to me, because I think those things that we're hoping for, those things we imagine, those things that didn't happen are as important to us as the things that do.
Do you remember what the very first thing you wanted to do with this project? I sort of already covered this with Deborah and Mitchell, so I thought I'd ask you as well. Do you remember the sort of ignition spark?
Well, I guess I've always seen my imagination working as a kind of reaction to something I don't understand. So in the past, that's been, you know, a church in Montana that thought the world would end, or a father and daughter living in Forest Park. And this time it was artifacts of my life that I came upon when I was with my daughters, and I thought, I was in a little shack where I used to live, and I was surrounded by rejection letters that I had posted up in 1993 and 1994 from various places and other images, and I thought, this person should never have continued on this path. And then I thought, who was this person? I was simultaneously, it was very uncanny, I was embarrassed. So this time, the thing that was outside of me that I didn't understand was someone who was allegedly continuous with me. Mm-hmm. So I was just trying to react to the artifacts that I found and trying to see what came out of me.
So the other selves that, like what I think it was Mitchell was talking about for you, were other yous. Like you were, the other selves that you were trying to sort of get a picture of were these past versions of the self in a way. Is that fair?
Yeah, some attempt at imagining what was going on exactly.
That's rad.
Yeah.
Deborah Mitchell, is there anything else about this spark, this impetus to begin the project, and maybe how it changed from how where you ended when you hit send? I don't know, do we hit send anymore? I don't know what we do.
Yeah, we hit send.
Yeah.
Go for it. All right, so when I wrote my novel, you know, it was like, you know, a story of my life. It's, you know, it's a, it works as for a publisher. They're like, oh yeah, you know, poor guy, look what he's overcome, here he is. And some of the, even the praise was very much centered on the voice. Mm-hmm. And the story, and I thought, damn, they don't even think I have a brain. And then, so I said, oh, I know what I'll do. I'll make them reckon with the way that I think. I'm gonna write some essays. Because to me, essays are like the clearest way to force a reader to kind of confront your thinking. And so it really started as that, me being angry about feeling like I was diminished in the publishing world and wanting someone to kind of reckon with how I think, though that could not sustain me. So the more that I got into the project, the more I realized I was telling a story about my community. And it felt very much less about me. Like even when you were saying, oh, read a part that's kind of about yourself, like I feel like every essay is me looking outward except for maybe one of them. So the kind of anger and feeling affronted did not sustain 7 years of writing this project, but it sure did get it going, though.
That's great. And it was anger that the voice was championed as something extra special when it seemed like. Could you just say a little more about that?
Yeah, well, I think publishers have a really, reviewers, critics, booksellers sometimes even have a way of racializing a book that's either subversive or they don't know that they're doing it. But like, look at how many books by writers of color and they say like, it's raw, mm-hmm. You know? Like they don't hardly ever say that for a book that's not by a writer of color. And then they'll, you know, if it's a book by a certain kind of writer, they'll say like, oh, it's brilliant or it's ingenious, or right? Mm-hmm. And then they'll say like, or if it's a book by a writer of color, say, oh, the voice is great, or wow, it's a really amazing story, mm-hmm. You know, heart wreck. So I watch, it seems to me like very coded language, almost like the way that they talk about athletes, right? Like how many times you hear them talk about a white athlete as like a beast?
Right.
They're intelligent.
Right.
And, yeah.
So go look at the jacket copy of your favorite authors and see how they describe the books. Now, I don't know if everybody's doing it on purpose, but it is clearly to me something that's pervasive in the way that we talk about books.
I think that's right, yeah. And I think sometimes it can be gendered as well.
Yeah,
like a
absolutely.
Male memoir will be unflinching,
yeah.
and a woman, a female memoir will be like heartfelt,
yes.
You know? And it's like, man, I don't flinch.
Yeah.
Like, come on.
Yeah.
I do think that the voice in survival math is, if I could like give it like an image in my brain, it's it's acrobatic. It takes a lot of different forms. You have the survival files that you're talking about, which are these kind of interstitial stories of other people. Mm-hmm. And then you have this kind of really jazzy way of speaking about like life stories. Mm-hmm. There's research reportage that sort of slams like sort of famous Western white Lotharios, mm-hmm. with, you know, sort of some Portland 80s and 90s hot guys.
Yeah.
Do you consider that also a response to this conversation about voice?
Absolutely. I wanted to do multiple things, and one of the things I think about is how historians and academics, the language, it almost feels like they're using the language as almost like a shield, like they don't want other people to penetrate it. So I wanted to take that information and then filter it through this idea. So I was trying to like take the Academy's information and then put it through a Northeast Portland old head and see what come out of it.
That's awesome. Deborah, can I circle back to something that's sort of related with you, with this great verb that you used when you were talking about the main external narrative in your book, although you go so far back into the stories of your own family and the families of the first white people to settle in Washington and in the Pacific Northwest, but you used the tool of Narcissa was pry bar. Mm-hmm. In what ways is Narcissa a pry bar for the self? Was that an original intention? Did it change as you moved through?
Well, you know, I thought at first I was going to write a book about a woman I despised, and then how to make peace with that. And it turned out that after 7 years of writing, I finally realized that what had to happen in the book is that I had to recognize her humanity, because that's what happened in my own interior. I think she made just terrible mistakes. She should have never come. You know, all those things. It cascaded into a disaster for everyone. But what I think when I finally realized, there's a place in the book where her only child drowned because the parents were, it was the Sabbath, they were reading their Bibles, and they wanted to teach her not to bother them on the Sabbath day. I'm sure you do that all the time. And so she came in and said, I'm going to go get water for dinner with the cups, and they just ignored her, and she went down to the river and drowned. She was two. And so I don't think Narcissa ever recovered from that. And I think and I'm probably reading a lot into her, which I do a lot in this book, but I felt like that had to be a moment of crisis for her when she realized that the person that she was shaped to be, that she was mandated to be, this mm-hmm. religious, this person who was devoted to her God, had, because of that, allowed her child to drown. Mm. And at that moment, I thought, oh my gosh, she's a real person. And I, of course, I was thinking of that along the way, but that moment, and then this letter she wrote to her father about it, just about killed me. I thought, wow, she suffered. She suffered a lot. Mm-hmm. And it's funny that I think that this person who made so many other people suffer, when I started to recognize the way that she suffered, it just cracked something open in the whole book for me. Huh. And I could start really seeing the book for what it was. And, you know, one day I realized this is a book about women's grief.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't know that until I was deep into it. My grandmother's grief, my great-grandmother's grief, and Narcissa's grief, and all the ways the Frontier West told women, do not grieve.
Mm-hmm.
If you grieve, you're weak. And so that meant a lot to me to get to that point. So it was a huge churning business for me all along, but yeah.
That's so wonderfully complicated and risky to take another person's story and learn about it and then have it open up this conversation inside yourself. And I bring up the risky thing not because I think it shouldn't be done, but because I think that kinetic energy, that risk, is one of the things that allows us to understand the stories that we tell.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it sort of pry bars us into sort of being like, oh, this is really why I'm involved in this. Mm-hmm. Could you say just a little bit more about, I mean, the title of the memoir, Deborah, is I Am a Stranger Here Myself. Mm-hmm. And there are a bunch of situations in which the speaker feels sort of on the outside, like driving with the truck, like in your first piece that you read, and as a member of a family, and as a Western person. Could you talk about some ways in which you reported from the outside that were also risky, or that where the risk sort of ignited the book in any way? I know I didn't send you this
sure.
question ahead of time. I hope you're okay.
I will say that you know, my family lives on. You know, the part of my book is about the fact that my parents were in high school when I was born. My father had just finished his sophomore year. And so he's, you know, we're the same age now. My father, we get to this age where he doesn't seem that much older than me anymore. And, I suffered about him reading this book. Suffered.
Wow.
And almost quit because of that several times. So, you know, that was constantly on my mind, that my family was going to read the book. Mm. And how could I not cowered out around that?
And this is your second personal work of personal nonfiction, so that doesn't go away when you get one out to, no?
No.
Oh, Deborah, come on.
It was worse this time.
Oh, it was worse? All right, well, I quit. Okay, so maybe we have time for one more question, and then we'll open it up for the group. So everybody get your burning questions ready. Pete, I was thinking about what Mitchell was saying about voice and thinking about sort of the page voice that you decided on or that you found for The Night Swimmers. Mm-hmm. There's like a moment where I think somebody's talking about how they don't ever want to use a semicolon, and then a semicolon appears in the sentence. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I'm talking about? And it seems like the choices that you're making moving from sentence to sentence are really deliberate in terms of what you want the book to do. Mm-hmm. Is that a conscious choice, or is this all just coming out of the tank, so to speak?
I think, as people have said, there's a huge difference between intention and the reality of a book, and a lot of it has to do with editing. And I think that, you know, I used to think about writing or being a writer as an identity, and now I see it more as a practice, mm-hmm. and I'm trying to be a person who likes to write. And I try to focus on writing projects or writing sentences without thinking about sharing them. And I write a lot of things I don't share, and this was one where I wasn't sure it was going to surface. But like most things I write, you know, it was once 1,000 pages long, and so trying
right?
to figure out how to cut something down and what did belong or what the voice would be. I think that everyone has their particular talents when they write, and my talent has always been ventriloquism of one kind or another, and I've never been able to write close to my identity, and this is the first time I tried to write closer to and with a voice of a, you know, a character who shared my gender and my past, my class, a lot of my experiences. And so, I mean, one thing I mentioned before is I got all these letters that I wrote when I was in my early 20s to this girlfriend of the time. And when I got them, and that's a longer story, I didn't want them, but once I had them, I read them, and I thought, these letters are so much better than anything I wrote during that time, fiction-wise. Yeah. And it was because I was trying to communicate to someone, one person, because I was lonely, and I wanted her to come where I was. And I thought, I want to write a book that's more like a letter. Mm-hmm. I want to write a book that is more focused on communicating in an intimate way, and whether or not that's something that everyone can appreciate reading, it's very unclear. But that was sort of, I was trying to write close to how I feel, I guess.
And don't you say in the book that you learned how to be a writer writing those letters, even though you were like trying to be a writer?
Writing terrible things, yeah.
And so what's the difference between 1,000-page Night Swimmers and the slimline 250-page Night Swimmers that we're all going to buy right after this panel is over?
It's something that, I teach writing, of course, and I used to have so many good answers for everything, but when you're working on a project for so long, figuring out what belongs is really hard, and that's a feeling. Like, belonging is such a strange and amorphous way to think of it. But a lot of it has to do with research, as I'm sure Deborah and Mitchell know. When you spend a lot of effort and time trying to find something that's really cool, your first impulse is to show it to everyone. So a lot of what editing is about is being like, oh, this is cool, but it doesn't belong to this. And it doesn't make everyone admire me that I found it. And so trying to figure out what the piece needs and what belongs and what is speaking to each other, and also to make space for the reader. To not over-explain everything. So I think we do a lot of writing to ourselves when we write things, and trying to cut that out is a big part of it.
Does anybody have any questions for our panelists? Great. So the question is, the ethics of writing a story about the self that involves others, what tactics do you use to resolve some of those issues, especially if some of the people you talk about might want to tell their own stories in the future?
I read a lot of memoir, teach memoir, and think about it way too much. And I think what I have come to in my own self, and you know, everybody has to draw their own lines in the sand on this, is that if I truly am most honest about my own plight and the way that I self-deceive all the time, and the way that I'm a walking contradiction, if I focus on there and really treat the other people in the book as the characters who are going to make me see myself better or more clearly, I guess, I feel that's my ethical responsibility. My first book is about my four daughters, and you know, I had to do a lot of negotiating with them because maybe they do want to write about themselves. In fact, the two older daughters and I did a This American Life piece together about that book, and they told their own story, and it blew my mind. I thought, oh my God, they have a story that's not my story. And it was a moment of great enlightenment for me. Again, it seems so obvious, but it's, you know, it's just woke me up in this profound way. Yeah, I mean, in this instance, I wrote a lot about dead people, and I tried to never put thoughts in their mind that I couldn't point to the research and say, there, right there is where I got that.
Mitchell or Pete?
Yeah, I think, well, one, you should follow, like, a good journalist ethics about, you know, quoting people. I did a lot of interviews. So the people knew that I was intentional, like, I'm going to write about this, you know. There's a recording of what you've told me. Then the other thing is, I think the people have to trust you, that you don't have any kind of malicious intent. But then also, like, about what if they want to write about it. Well, if they want to write about it, that's cool, because it's going to be a different story. Like, we're all sitting in this room. Every single person in this room would have a different story about what happened. And, you know, if you had a loved one sitting in this room, they would have a different story from you, too. So I don't really worry too much about that. I mean, my dad got mad at me for the residue years. I'm like, well, go ahead and write your story, man. You know, I spent 13 years on this, you know. This is my story. I know you got a story. Go ahead. You know, knock yourself out.
I think all three of you also report doubt a lot in your books, and I think that helps to tell a story and admit your fallibility as you're telling it. There's something about that that shows the reader this window into these things that you guys are saying about these other opportunities for storytelling that exist. Yeah.
It's such a huge question, and I think when you're listening to panel discussions, there's always this hope that there will be a distilled answer that we'll agree on, and I disagree with myself all the time. So it's kind of book to book, the rules change. I'm hiding behind this being fiction, so it's a different thing if you're writing fiction, and if you know a fiction writer and you read their books, you feel like, oh, I know who that is, or I know what's going on there. And I don't think that's often the case in the work that I've done, like it is in this book. I think there's something problematic about writing, you know, using other people's stories in the way that I have here. And I often just asked people, or I sent them sections of the book. I sometimes took things out if they didn't like it. I also wrote about my children and even used their pictures in a way that I never asked them. I think it's really wrong if you are taking largely fictionalized characters and having them interact with real people in your life and saying things and doing things they never did, but I did that. And I feel conflicted about it, but for me as a fiction writer, when it came down to it, I was always going to prioritize the story and not, like, and a reader picks up a novel wanting a story, not wanting the facts. And again, it's different for people who know me. The last terrible thing that I did is I always assumed that I would change everyone's names, and then I just didn't. It felt fake to me. I felt, and fortunately, you know, I'm on good terms with these people still because they've known me for a long time. But I think this was a case where I did some things that I felt like that's really kind of the wrong thing to do, and just to see how it felt.
Awesome. And I was really hoping we wouldn't get the time's up sign from Roseanne. I was like, oh, we're going to finish. We don't need that time's up sign, Roseanne. And Roseanne gave us the sign. So I think that means time's up. Thank you so much.
Thank y'all.
That was Deborah Gortney, Mitchell S. Jackson, and Peter Rock. Conversation, the Portland Book Festival 2019. The Portland Book Festival 2020 lineup has just been announced. The festival will take place on November 5th through the 21st, online and on the radio. For more information about the author lineup and schedule, visit literary-arts.org. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project is provided by Cole Hahn, on a mission to fuel your big ideas. More at colehahn.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast, with production oversight by Amanda Bullock and support from Liz Olofsson. Special thanks to Joe T. Roy and Alana Phelan and the entire Literary Arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another episode of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.